historically splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Philippe. Exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. Aleister Crowley had an admiration for Islam and tried to immerse himself in Sufi spaces on a few occasions. The Islamic influence on Thelema is sometimes overt, but often implicit. Author Uthman Kanadi will discuss the Islamic influence on Thelema and on modern hermetics more generally. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love with the law, love under will.
Welcome, Ken. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Darren.
Yeah, so we're welcoming our guest today, Ken, who's with us representing the Brethren of Gold. Can you tell us a little bit about the Brethren of Gold?
Yeah, of course. So the Arabic version of the name is the Ikhwanus Dahab, which means Ikhwan means brother, us means of, and Dahab means gold. So it's a reconstructionalist movement from a Islamic society called the Ikhwan al-Safa, which means the Brethren of Purity. So the Brethren of Purity was a well-renowned Islamic, almost like secret society, almost like fraternity almost, that had like many esoteric Muslims across the board from Sunni, Shia, Ismaili. It didn't matter what denominational background you came from. They all like came together to kind of form like a single.
So that sort of sounds a little bit like Rosicrucianism.
Yeah, it was Rosicrucianism before Rosicrucianism, actually. Yeah, it was quite Rosicrucian in nature. It covered, they had their own thing called the Rasail al-Ikhwan al-Safa, which means the epistles of the Brethren of Gold. And this had a compilation of different ideas, Brethren of Gold, Brethren of Purity, and where they had their different ideas and kind of different doctrines kind of compacted into one kind of epistle, kind of similar to how like what Paul was doing with his epistles to the churches, trying to kind of form like what the doctrine should be based on Christ around. Yeah, so the Brethren of Gold aims to revitalize hermeticism in an Islamic background and sense, but instead of doing it through the lens of classical to middle hermeticism, I'm doing it with the aspect of neo-hermeticism. So it's a neo-hermetic Islamic, although it says Brethren on it, it's irrespective of it's of gender and sexual orientation and identifying backgrounds. Anybody who is eager to learn about the Middle Eastern hermetic lens is able to join. It's not, Brethren is just phrased that way to pay homage to the predecessors that came before me. So yeah, the Brethren of Gold is a YouTube channel of almost 1,000 subscribers that covers the Islamic elements within neo-hermetic practices. One of the topics we actually cover is Thelema. We covered the topic of Islamic appearances in Thelema, which I will get into later on into this podcast.
Yeah.
On examples on how that is present. And we use numerology, we use symbology, we use scripture, we use a wide variety of different practices and scopes to kind of piece it all together under one banner that is the banner of neo-hermeticism. The Brethren of Gold is also a Discord server that has well over 200 members in it, and where it serves as like a forum posting for different schools of thoughts, different religious people. They're some of the top moderators of there are actually not neo-hermeticists like me. They're actually more of like these new agers and more of like the casual spiritualist. But regardless, irrespective of where you come from, the Brethren of Gold is always opening their arms to new people and new backgrounds. And
yeah, it sounds like there's probably a certain degree of eclecticism going
on. 100% eclecticism. Yeah, I would agree.
So what kinds of backgrounds
do you find come together with this, like in terms of the study?
A lot of like backgrounds that wouldn't otherwise have come to my group known about the Golden Dawn and like neo hermetic kind of like influences, like a lot of new agers who I explained to them, like, hey, you guys use like horary and natal astrology, and that thrives off of the lunar zodiac in many cases. And what they use for the lunar zodiacs or the lunar mansions is actually an Arabic system. There's two distinct lunar zodiacal systems. There's the Manzil, which comes from Arab divination. And then there's the Nakshatras, which come from the Vedic divination. So when Western astrology is being formed, I'm not like well-versed in history of why, but for some reason, unknown reason, that to me, they picked the Manzil system as representing their lunar zodiac instead of the Nakshatras, which I find to be quite compelling. Because even the names of the Manzils are still retained through many different modern astrological practices. So I'll go to different New Agers and be like, hey, you see this? Another thing is Rider-Waite Tarot, you know, like that was which was made by Arthur E. Waite. There is actually a reference, like almost like a Sefer Yetzirah in the Quran, almost a little bit, called Surah Buruj. Which means the mansion of the stars. And it has 22 verses in it that have almost like an alignment with the Hebrew letters in it.
Cool.
Yeah.
I forget. Okay, I'm blanking how many letters there are in the Arabic.
28.
Alphabet. Okay, yeah. And I guess that depends on if you differentiate between...
It depends on which era you go to. So in the original Quranic script, there was only 14 Arabic letters. But two of those Arabic letters are of those 14 can be seen as the same one. So this one being... one of them being Kaf and Qaf. So these can be seen as like almost the same letter in Arabic. And then the other one, I believe, is Ta and Tet, or Ta and Ta, which are like seen as like the same one. That for one of for certain was in the original 14 was Kaf and Qaf. But even in the original 14 Arabic letter system, because you could rule out two as the same, that leaves you with 12. So they had the zodiacal associations with the 14 Arabic letters. Yeah, and with the 28 Arabic letters, just like how the 22 Hebrew letters have their correspondences, there's correspondences with the 28 Arabic letters too in regards of the 28 lunar mansions. So each lunar zodiacal phase has a connection to one of the Arabic letters. And this is something that's enlisted in the Shamval Ma'arif, which is like a very classical. It's also in the Picatrix too, which I'm aware that Tausif has done a wonderful workshop on. Under you guys' jurisdiction, which I think is really amazing. I would have been elated to have seen that.
Yeah, you know, it's with the subject of the Arabic letters as well. They appear in Liber 777 with correspondences, but not a lot of attention gets paid to that.
They don't, and especially in relation to where it's lined up with is the Greek alphabet in Liber 777. It doesn't just line up with its gematria correspondences. Also lines up, tries to line up with the Greek alphabet, which I find to be quite compelling because there is certain Islamic lexicons that use Greek, that have Greek origins in them. Like, for example, like, it's long disputed on if, I'm not of this opinion, but the Orthodox Muslims like to say that, that the character Idris comes from the name Esdras, which wouldn't be the Hebrew version of Ezra, but would be the Greek version, Esdras, Idris Esdras, right? So, but the most common example I would say of a Quranic definition using Greek terms is one of the previous scriptures in the Quran, they call it the Injil. Now, this is actually the Arabic word for gospel, but this is rooted in the Greek word evangelist.
Yeah, it's interesting, all the cross-pollinization, because, I mean, clearly, like, in ancient times, there was a lot of the merchant pathways and stuff like that where, you know, there's a lot of sharing overlap. Of information and overlap and influence and that sort of thing. I mean, even the term gematria is, like one take on it is that it's derived from the same root as geometry.
Yeah. Because so. They saw numbers as symmetrical. They saw numerology as a symmetrical kind of like,
thing. Yeah, not to mention that it implies a lot of the with the Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. I mean, we have the formation of the Tree of Life now, but in other times, at different times, there would have been, for instance, concentric circles working outwards.
Okay.
And so, like, you'd have the 10 Sephiroth displayed as concentric circles, which makes a lot of sense to me because of the fact that it's like, well, that's similar to the Chaldean order of the planets working out from Earth, if you think of the planetary spheres, and then the sphere of the zodiac. So that's an image that I really like, that sort of a way of displaying that. But I could totally see where you could read a lot of geometry into things there.
Yeah, 100%. Another cool thing is that there is some Kabbalistic literature and some Quranic legends too. Yeah, so Third Enoch is a really influential Kabbalistic literature. It falls under this subsection of literature called Hekalot literature. Are you familiar with Hekalot literature?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sort of maybe superficially, but...
I would think so, yeah.
But yeah, is Hekalot the
palace?
Oh, palace. Okay, I'm trying to remember the term that I'm thinking of. It's not coming to me, but so I'll have to just let that go.
Are you familiar with the Hebrew term Shir Koma?
No.
So this was actually in a sort of New Age-ish kind of text too. J.J. Hertak's Keys of Enoch, which actually we've read on live stream before.
Oh, yeah.
As a group, he uses this terminology Shir Koma, and Shir Koma is one of the Hekalot literatures, and it is just a full-on, like, Crowley would have had a field day with Shir Koma if he had access to it, because this is filled with, it is a dimension-by-dimension description of God's anthropomorphic body, basically. It's like God's anatomy, but it's like this side of here is this much cubits, and this limb is this much cubits, and this limb is that much cubits. And I feel like Crowley would have loved like that type of like numerology enlisted in there.
Is that like involved with the Zohar? Because that sounds very...
It could be, yeah. Mm. The Zohar, I mean, you're from with Arjun, right?
Yeah.
So he explained to me how that the Libra 777 is a good referential index for a lot of like the numerical and a lot of like the encoded mysteries in the Zohar. Almost like Libra 777 is almost like a cross reference. It's kind of like an interlinear, like cross reference kind of index that you can use to kind of better translate Zohar stuff. But you could link a lot of Zohar stuff in the in Hekalot literature. I would assume so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a good basis of Kabbalistic doctrine to understand. It's like people will read the Zohar, and also people will take like bits and pieces of maybe a little bit of Talmudic literature, like the Lilith story, and which is like, funny enough, people don't understand that's actually rooted in Talmudic literature.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think when you start the whole, I actually own two scholars elect Talmuds. I own Tractate Barachat, and I own Tractate Erubim 3.
No, oh, yeah.
So Tractate Barachat is all about when you are trying to learn the certain times on when it's all right to bless the congregation. So it's like, okay, when does the Sabbath start truly in the terms of the sky, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all these different rabbinical commentaries on, okay, like, when's the right timing for blessing? When's the right timing to eat the offering? When's the right timing to kind of contextualize things? So what I've been doing a little bit with, like, the dimensions and like the timings put in like these Talmudic literatures, I've been using the 777 correspondence. But I'm going to get into my first point here, which is something I wanted to address, and that's like that 777 I think is a very good index for, well, like Crowley claims, it's good for Kabbalistic like kind of like implications and literature, even in Talmudic and Midrash, right? Which is like talking about like the more the metaphors of the Torah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great Kabbalistic kind of like symbology in the Midrash and the Talmud that I think a lot of people just kind of zip over the head because they just kind of skip straight to the Zohar, right? It's like all about the Zohar and it's all about what's at the root, what's more overtly Kabbalistic, but what the things that are more internally Kabbalistic through its symbology, I think can be quite interesting to unravel.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so that's what I want to get into, one of my first things I want to talk about. And that is a article I'm actually going to be trying to write for the Toronto Thelema newsletter.
Cool.
It's a future article. And this is, I call it the Images of the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
The Images of the Beast. It is a little bit of history. There is a In ancient Turkey, which is the region known as Haran, right? So it's the ancient region in what is known today as Turkey. There was actually, and if you read the book of Acts, it even goes into this, like the New Testament. It details that one of the pilgrimage places that Abraham himself went to was a place called Haran, which it was one of the places he had to eventually cross through in his travels throughout his pilgrimage, right? So one of the regions he visits is the Turkish region of Haran. And people would automatically assume from that position that, oh, so the Haranians must have been like these staunch, like monotheistic, like religious people, right? But there was actually an outpour of Neoplatonic and Hermetic influences in the Haranian region. And what happened was this is something me and Thels have talked about. But one of these surviving Neoplatonic and what they called themselves Sabians, one of the surviving Neoplatonic and astrological hermetic kind of practitioners there was a man named Thabit ibn Gura.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he basically did some paperwork with the reigning sovereigns at the time that were kind of like iffy about like, if these practices that they were doing, these astrological practices, were actually, you know, like fit under the law, right? But Thabit ibn Gura, he did like extensive amount of paperwork and kind of advocating for his people and made almost like what me and Dalsa both agreed to be a manifesto of all of his people in one. Actually, I brought it with me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I brought it with me if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a nice look at it if you'd like. But it's a nice, compact, like, manifesto of all of his people. It's called De Imaginibus, or hence why I called it the Images of the Beast, on images.
Yeah.
And it is a talismanic grimoire that details... here, you can...
Thanks.
Yeah. It's translated by John Michael Greer.
Yeah,
who's a very famous hermeticist, as many people would know, John Michael Greer. John Michael Greer didn't just translate this, but he also translated the Picatrix. Christopher Warnock does the commentary on this as well, who is like a huge Renaissance. He's heavily into the Renaissance astrology and the Renaissance magic. So a huge component in Renaissance magic and astrology was Islamic stuff. It was through the Picatrix or the Gayat al-Hakim or the aim of the wise or the goal of the sage. And the Imaginibus is actually at the forefront of a lot of stuff. Are you familiar with Agrippa?
Mm-hmm, of course.
Yeah, his three books of occult philosophy. If you look within the...
I was going to say, there's like some references in here as well.
Agrippa uses some of the Ibn Qura's talismanic instructions within his three books of occult philosophy. I think if you have a certain commentated version, it'll actually have the Latinized version of his name, like Tebe Ibn Qura.
Oh yeah,
which is like his Latinized version. There's actually a crater.
I actually have the three books of occult philosophy in Latin.
Really,
it's like a copy of a Renaissance printing.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I'd have to look. I'll have to look that up and see if I can find.
Do they have footnotes in it too?
I don't think so because it's an older, you know, text. But it's like I would like to look up the name of Thabit and see how it's rendered there just out of curiosity.
Yeah, it should be spelled Thebit in Latin. Thabit would be Thabit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's more of like the English romanization of it. But the Latins call him Tebit. And Tabe Bunkura is actually, he is host to two specific things that are quite popular. Number one, there's a crater named Tebet. They named the crater one of these, I think on one of these asteroids or one of these, I'm not too sure about which crater belongs to, but the Tabe Bunkura has such a influence on something that he created, they named a crater after him. Mm-hmm. Second of all, Tabe Bunkura created a mathematical function called a Thabit number, a 3-2-1 number. Mm-hmm. And I have a documentary in where I called the document, like a documentary on Tabe Bunkura, and where I use artificial intelligence to create computer codes, computer programs out of the functions that he used in his mathematical finals. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. It was able to create Python, a JavaScript, a C++, and it was able to generate the sections of the type of factorizations of his number theory spectrum.
Cool. When was he alive?
The Middle Ages.
Okay, yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Dark Ages for the West.
Yeah, Dark Ages for the West, but the Islamic Golden Age.
Yeah, the Renaissance for everyone else, basically.
Yeah, the Islamic Golden Age.
So much going on there, so much advancement in mathematics, science, medicine, all these different fields. 100%. And everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it only eventually came over and echoed into the Renaissance in the West with when some of those things started to seep into the West, including like the ancient Greek stuff that was preserved by those means or through Constantinople or whatnot. So
Turkey, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. Which is were you mentioning Abraham having gone to Turkey? Was
yeah,
that what
yeah,
saying?
Haran. Yeah, he went to Haran, mm-hmm. according to
Is
the
Is this
book
like
of
the Abraham from Genesis?
The Abraham from Genesis. Yeah.
That's amazing. For some reason, it's shocking to me to think that he was actually that far afield.
Yeah. It is listed in the book of Acts. I don't have the scripture with me, but it's on my...
Yeah, I'll have to look that up and check it out.
Yeah, I could. Yeah. It's actually, the scripture is listed, it's in the introduction to that book, if you find it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
cool.
The Book of Acts kind of like rehashes a lot of like Jewish history to kind of like, I guess, to kind of like familiarize they have the story of the burning bush in the Book of Acts. They have some stories about Abraham in the Book of Acts to kind of like relay certain Old Testament kind of stories legitimize them within a New Testament kind of perspective. Yeah. I guess I should now segue into my topic about what I'm going to hopefully produce for your article.
Mm-hmm.
Most people interact with De Imaginibus almost like a relic of the past. They kind of read it to like, okay, so this is what the Haranians were doing at this time. No one has too much of an intention to actually enact what this talismanic tutorial is actually teaching us to do. And I think a lot of it is because a lot of it is under this huge, like, it's under initiatory kind of terminologies that the average person wouldn't really be adapt to.
Yeah.
But with the beauty of 777 is it almost revitalizes these like terminologies and puts them into like angelic, goetic, all these different type of correspondences you can put within these like astrological symbologies and different styles.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was able to do and what I'm in the midst of working on right now is a 777 correspondences with De Imaginibus.
Cool.
Where I take Crowley's basically like astrological correspondences and I line it up with the basis of what Ibn Qura is instructing with his talismans.
Mm-hmm.
And I even took some Heptarchy of stuff in there too.
Cool.
Because it says, in some certain aspects, it tells you to inscribe the Lord of the Hour of the Day.
Uh-huh.
So the cool thing about the Heptarchy, if anyone is familiar with the Heptarchy, it is John Dee's Mysticism of the Sevenfold Dominion, which I also have with me as well. I brought a bunch of books with me.
Cool.
It is John Dee's planetary magic system, and where he envelops these seven ancient spheres and has different kings and princes, maybe possibly similar to the Gaetia. Because mm-hmm. whenever I tell people about kings and princes, they say, that sounds a lot like Gaetia. And I'm like, possibly. Yeah, you might be onto something there. So, and within the seven ancient planets, or the seven ancient spheres, they have these magic squares, which sound very similar to, look very similar to the Arabic magic square system, and where they have something called the 42 ministers. Mm-hmm. And in the heptarchial 42 ministers, they have six ministers with seven letter names. So there's six names with seven letters for each and every single one of them. Mm-hmm. And these actually are designated to the 4-hour intervals in a 24-hour cycle. Mm-hmm. So like the first name would be from midnight to four.
Yeah.
So as I go on and so forth until the 24 hours of the day is kind of up. So I even use heptarchial correspondences to kind of fit in the mold of like, okay, so what you could do with this talisman. And it's pure conjecture. It's not like it's saying like, oh, like you have to like correspond to it like this. It's to create my purpose of coming to Toronto Tlema today, my purpose of bringing in my voice here today. And it kind of, this is my first ever podcast actually I've ever done. So I'm quite grateful.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for popping the cherry with us. Yeah, so we have these heptarchic angels that you're talking about, and mm-hmm. how they apply also to De Imaginibus as well.
Oh, you got the Latin down. Yeah, awesome. Yeah, on images. Yeah, it can in the aspect of if you're trying to align with the planetary hours, or if you're trying to align with like certain planetary aspects, you could mm-hmm. just use the heptarchial ministers, which have, because my friends like to use more of the mutable planetary hours, where it's depending on when the sun rises. So yeah. It's like the sunrise, okay, now we start the planetary hours.
So the hours of the day might be shorter if it's, you know, midwinter or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Not even that, but that's not even the only way of gauging planetary hours that most people would, like, contrary to popular belief. Like, in the Shamvel Ma'arif, which is, like the handbook for Islamic occultism, because it's, like, a talismanic kind of grimoire, mm-hmm. They have fixed planetary hours. So no matter what, the first hour is always going to be this planet, the second hour is always going to be this planet, the third hour is going to be this planet. So when you look at the more of like the Middle Eastern kind of like views of the planetary hours, they always saw them as completely just cut and dry, like fixed, depending on the day. Like it was just going to be fixed always on these types of hours or these types of mixes on it. So that concludes my first point on, I have four.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my first point I want to say, is that you could line up 777 correspondences with ancient Sabian talismanic instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing I want to talk about is actually something you put me onto, Darren.
Okay.
When I went to one of your events, I got a free copy of Libra 150.
Mm-hmm.
And Libra 150 gave me, and this book
is
actually...
Oh, you talked about Libra 65. Oh, no, it was the Libra 150. Okay, I know you're talking about. Libra Libellum. Yeah, right.
Libra Libellum, yeah. This book is actually a response to Libra 150.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a response to it.
You mean this one that you...
Yeah, The Four Weapons of a True Rule.
You wrote this one, yeah.
It's a response to Libra 150.
Cool.
So at the end of Libra 150, it canonizes four texts, Class A documents, that he claims to be supreme documents. And he called... The four are Libra Arita, Libra Lapis Lazuli, Libra Liberi Lapis Lazuli, there's Libra Trigrammaton, and then there's Libra 65, which mm-hmm. also you guys were nice enough to give me a copy of too. Mm-hmm. So Libra Arita is pretty interesting because it has heavy, heavy Islamic imagery.
Yeah,
It starts off with the 112th chapter of the Quran, which is Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, Qul huwallahu ahad, Allahu samad, lam yalid wa lam yulad, wa lam yakul lahu kufuwan ahad. Which means, say he is God, God the Eternal. He does not beget, nor is he begotten, and there's none ever like him. Mm. And in chapter 3 of Libra Arita, there's a literal English translation of this of this chapter in there.
Mm-hmm.
That he claims to have recites like numerous times in the night, basically.
Yeah, he would use it as a mantra very commonly, and he would also mentions during the reception of, or I guess working through the aethers of Libra 418.
Oh yes, yes, I'm familiar with it. He would recite the Quran during the reception of the vision.
Yeah,
the
so he'd be he would be reciting this and doing prostrations in the desert. He would try to do it 1,001 times before opening each aether.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm not familiar with that. He would actually actively use Islamic principles into his scrying of the ethers. That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool. Awesome. Yeah, so there we got it right there from the man himself that Crowley did have like mantric kind of repetitions. But speaking of mantras, that's not the extent of Crowley's usage of Islamic stuff in Libra Arita. And the fourth chapter of Libra Arita, I don't know if Crowley himself was aware of this, but he used the five main mantras that Sufis like to chant, which is Subhanallah, Alhamdulillah, La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah, which means glory be to God, all praise be to God, there is none worthy of worship but God, God is greater, and there is no power and might except for God.
Mm.
So those five mantras are enlisted in chapter 4 of Libra Arita. And the cool thing about this is that in Confessions, have you read Confessions?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So in Confessions, Crowley writes about the... Actually, I'm very, very perplexed that he knew who this was, because I've covered this man on my YouTube channel before. The Sultan al-Arifin, or the King of the Gnostics, his name was Bayezid Bastami. Bayezid Bastami was heavily, heavily revered in Sufic circles, and even Crowley recognized this reverence too for reaching the state of purity and reaching like the state of high spiritual station called, and in Sufism we call it Al-Fana.
Mm-hmm.
And Al-Fana, although it has some somewhat daunting implications behind it, Al-Fana meaning annihilation, or some Sufis characterize it as dying before dying.
Mm-hmm.
Some more of the softer Sufis and more of like the calmer ones, like specifically the ones in Morocco, just simply call it effacement. Like, so effacement obviously means like a form of erasure. The idea is that when you've reached a high state of purity in prayer and meditation, and you are graced with the presence of the divine, the ego is effaced entirely within the presence. There is no more you. It's just your body filled with the divine, basically. So,
a question for you. Pardon my ignorance, but that brings to mind images of Muhammad where there's like the face specifically.
Covered.
Or
yeah.
It looks effaced or, you know, blanked out.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. I don't know if that relates in any way.
That was mainly, so the reason why they kind of covered Muhammad's face in iconography was because the Muslims place Muhammad in a very high station and a high regard. And the way they saw it was that any sort of depiction of his face could influence people to worship that image. When they didn't want people to center around the person, they want to center around who the person was pointing at.
Yeah.
Right? So that could possibly be one. That could possibly be one, that an indication of it. But actually, that was good you mentioned Muhammad, because that goes into my point I'm going to tease next after that. Crowley's mentioning of Muhammad in Libra of Allegis chapter 3, verse 52. So nice. I got that on lock for you guys next.
Yeah, I was gonna say, nice having that straight from memory there.
I'm familiar with it because I wrote a book on it.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. But basically in the Sufi practice, these five main dhikrs, who have five main mantras, which I recited earlier for you guys, that opens the gates to Al-Fana. And in Crowley's Confessions, he said that Bayezid Bastami was one of the people who he acknowledged what the Sufi said about him reaching the state of Al-Fana, and he likened the Sufi's goal and pursuit towards Al-Fana as the ceremonial magician's pursuit to crossing the abyss. And he saw like the Sufic pursuit and the ceremonial magician's pursuit as one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
One and the same process, basically.
Yeah.
And where Crowley likened the Sufic journey of ascending, what Crowley might have liked about Bayezid Bastami was his introduction of journeying towards the presence of God, going on that journey, going on that level of that, those degrees of knowing and those degrees of journeying towards the destination.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have the full quote of what he said, but in Confessions, but he did hold Bayezid Bastami to a high regard, which I give him kudos for.
He has a number of anecdotes relating to Sufism and Islam and whatnot. So that's one of those things that I'm fascinated by as well, and I think it's something definitely worthy of much more study and research.
Yeah. And in the constraints of that book, and also hopefully, also it was a portion of that book and also article I wrote for Translima, I made a numerical correspondence to how even the numbers in Libra Arita line up with the 112 chapter, like the gematria of the verses of 112. In fact, the first verse of chapter 112 is valued at 220, which is a code for the Book of Allah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the second verse is valued at 231, which is a code for Kabbalah, which is the 231 gates, which is like the combination of the Hebrew letters. Like, it's 22 times 21 divided by a certain number. But it equals to 231, so the 231 gates of Kabbalah. So there's a lot of ancient and like now what most people consider modern Hermeticism within the constraints of Islam. So that brings me on to that concludes my second point.
Mm-hmm.
So my third one is the mentioning of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the Book of Allah. So when I talk to certain Thelemites about this specific topic, they kind of brush it off as, or they're almost already apologizing for him, for me, as if I don't see the symbolism in it.
Yeah.
At least I don't see like past like his phrasing. They're like, oh, I'm sorry, like Crowley just likes to take a shot at everyone, or it's like, I'm sorry, you're not finding any information here. He's just being blasphemous.
But, yeah, wonderful.
But I've done the numerology for the verse verse in mind. I've done the numerologies in contrast to the different mentionings of Muhammad in the Quran. I've done numerology with the hidden code in chapter 2 verse 76.
Which verse are you looking for?
The one with the hidden code in it.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that I think is like probably 74 or something like that. 73 or 74.
Something in the 70s.
I should know that. I memorized the damn chapter recently. So
oh, you memorized it recently. Yeah. Awesome.
But yeah, the code that's like 4638 ABKL.
I have a shameless plug, but I have a book on Amazon called The Blinding Wings where I cracked that code.
Oh, okay.
Using the first verse of the Quran, which is like it's almost like the Da Vinci Code for Muslims. Almost they break down the linguistic structure of it. They break down the gematria of it. They break down like what exactly is this code. And I'm like, I put two and two together. I'm like, what is the Thelemic version of the first verse of the Quran? And where everyone like numerically breaks it down and like numerically kind of like jumbles it and mixes up with it. And I was like, and I was reading through the Kabbalah, and funny enough, one of my friends talked about how, are you familiar with J. Daniel Gunther?
Oh, yeah.
So J. Daniel Gunther, from what I heard, he used either the I Ching or the Tao Te Ching, I think, to decode some of that Book of Allah code in it.
Mm.
He used some Orientalist Eastern numerology. So that kind of sparked the idea in my mind. I was thinking like, what can I do with Islamic numerology? Because that's like very abundant, and at this point I didn't even know about the Arabic letters in 777.
Mm-hmm.
But I had basically done a syncretic blend of basically mixing the first verse of the Quran and the code enlisted in the Book of Allah. And I'm not going to spoil the results, but the result may shock you. It was quite symmetrical.
Interesting.
So that leads me on to my third point, and the third point being, why did Crowley mention Muhammad in the Book of Allah? What's like his take? What's like his gist he's trying to get at here? Is he just taking a stab at religious people? Is he just trying to be blasphemous? I don't think so. What he's actually talking about is something pretty interesting. First of all, I want to ask this with an intriguing kind of view on maybe how he's seen this. Would you consider illiteracy to be a form of blindness?
I suppose so, yeah. That's an interesting way of taking it.
So possibly the way we could see Crowley saying, I flap my wings in the face of Muhammad and blind him. Remember that in the previous lines in that scripture, he's talking also about being on the cross that Jesus was on when he was crucified. So in these two, and that's not even like a line away from like what he said. It's not even a line prior. Probably not even two lines prior. Probably within the same recent lines in that scripture. So what Crowley's insinuating with saying, you know, the stuff about saying about being with Jesus on his cross and then flapping his wings in the face of Muhammad and blinding him, what that means from my view is that he is saying that the presence of his holy guardian angel or Iwas, or what he is channeling, has a ancient symbology and has an ancient presence and is present during these religious leaders' most crucial moments. So for Jesus, his moment is when he's crucified. For Muhammad, people, if you're not learned, you may not really understand which is the most crucial moment for Muhammad, but seems Crowley did, because Muhammad's most crucial moment for at least most Muslims is his ascension up the heavens. So when he's on the heavens, he's on, get this, so make a little bit more context to why he's saying I'm flap my wings in the face of Muhammad and blinded. The reason why he says that is because Muhammad climbs up and scales up the seven heavens on a winged horse called the Burak, which means a thunder. Funny enough, Burak is where we get the name Barak from, is what I heard.
Okay.
Yeah. So Burak, which means thunder. You can almost tell it kind of sounds like a Burak.
Yeah.
Like almost like an onomatopoeia. Yeah, you got it.
What the hell does onomatopoeia sound like anyway? Why is that word so long?
Yeah. It's not like palindrome or reverse palindrome where it's got like
like pop, like we were looking at last night in the ethers.
Interesting.
No, that's fascinating. That's a really interesting take on it. I hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah.
One thing I do like to try and annoy people with is like reminding them that you could say Crowley wrote the Book of the Law. I don't, because I kind of if you buy into it for what it is, it's not Crowley having authored it. Like he claimed not to have authored it. Channeling it.
He's channeling it from his HGA, right?
He claimed that Iwas was his HGA, but basically, yeah, he said that Iwas was standing in the corner and dictating it to him. Which is, of course, there's since been people who like to make the joke of, then Crowley would go and tell people about the Book of the Law, and they'd say, like, who wrote it? And he said, or who was the author of it? And he'd say, I was.
I was.
But it's like I like to catch people on that, because these are supposed to be channeled texts.
Yes.
And so that's like whether or not you believe that is one thing, but it's kind of like especially in the case of the Book of the Law, it's like that's that one he in especially took no credit for
He held in very high esteem, was like, no, this could not be for me.
I get
what you're saying. I feel like every artist has their own magnum opus that they think is like, this is beyond even my prowess, or beyond even what I like think I'm capable of as a person.
I think
a lot of occult authors, when you get into like making, I can speak from my own respects as like somebody who's made like content and makes like writings, I don't have like as much as confidence as Crowley to be like, that's beyond me. But I've definitely had moments where I'm like, damn, like, I didn't intend for me to, like, do this, but it kind of weaved in this way, and it makes me think that there's some sort of inner force I'm tapping into when I'm making.
Yeah, and as an artist, it's like the channeling aspect does feel like it can feel pretty powerful and like it's coming from somewhere else.
100%.
But even to that extent, like Crowley specifically talks about the Book of the Law as being one of the important aspects of it being that it's evidence of an external intelligence that's separate from himself, that's not, as he says, discarnate, so unfleshed.
Discarnate. Wow. Yeah. I like that phrasing a lot. Yeah. Very good phrasing, yeah.
Yeah, and like I say, it's like, I'm not trying to convince anyone, but that's kind of the project. That's kind of like, you know, what he's trying to put forward as why the Book of the Law is valuable. Mm-hmm. So I always like to sort of point that out as being important because it's so easy to say that Crowley said this, but he doesn't claim that was
He never claimed it was him saying that.
Yeah, so
I think if we can hold respect for other Muslim faithful to say, well, Allah says this when you read the Quran, I'm sure people can have some sort of respect with the Elamites where they say,
yeah,
well,
similarly,
I was said this.
It's or, like the Bible as well. Like, I mean, certainly vast portions of it must have been written by human beings because it's a historical document.
Yeah.
But then again, many, many people believe that it is the word of God.
Yeah.
In all aspects of it and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's wiggle room, and it's like I say, I'm not trying to convince anyone.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's I just like to point that out, that's, you know, one consideration to have in terms of discussing the Book of the Law and that sort of thing, so.
Yes, sir.
But yeah, that's fascinating, though, because that's like, yeah, I have not thought of it or heard that sort of take on the aspect of Muhammad being included.
Yeah, people, I don't know, I've been tapping into certain Thelema communities and like reading the first chapter of the Book of the Law, Sunshine and Rainbows, reading the second chapter of the Book of the Law, reading the third chapter of the Book of the Law, and yeah. I'm like, what? Like, I'm not seeing what you guys are seeing in this. Like, the third chapter is pretty cool. Like, it's pretty metal. I don't know what you guys mean. Like, it's the scariest part of the book. Like,
and not only that, I feel like it's kind of like it's just saying it. Like, the way that Crowley says it in Magic Without Tears is he's like, well, you have a problem with what Iwas says. Well, so do I. The problem is he's not asking, he's telling you.
I remember that quote. Yeah, I remember that quote.
So it's kind of like just sort of, it's just saying it bald-faced without dressing it up and that sort of thing. So it's like, but yeah, I know what you mean. It's not nearly as bad as people make it out in one aspect, but there is a lot of apologetical kind of banter around it and that sort of thing at the same time, yeah, like particularly with that portion that you're referring to.
Yeah, I just think it's one of the most misunderstood portions.
Yeah, not only that, but I think it's like, if it's not challenging you, then maybe it's not doing its job.
Yeah, 100%.
If it's not uncomfortable, if you're not uncomfortable, maybe that's fine. But if you're sort of making apologies for it and that sort of thing, then maybe you need to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. So that's something you've experienced, eh? So you've experienced like some Thelemites having to like apologize for
Sure. That feels like a knee-jerk reaction, yeah.
Yeah, it is a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, it's kind of hypocrisy I'm seeing in where religious people don't like when people take one verse of scripture and be like, see, that's the aha moment. That's like showing that, you know, that, and people with a lack of better, I'm not saying that those Thelemites apologize and have a lack of better knowing. I'm just saying that a lot of people who tend to like only see it from a surface level will probably feel compelled to apologize for that one. Really, Crowley's actually saying that, no, you see what's happening is that during these religious people's most iconic moments, Jesus' crucifixion, Muhammad's ascension, that Iwas is a present element in those things. And notice how even in those specific examples, they're using animals. I also peep that, is that they use animals. So on the Jesus cross portion of it, it talks about the crow that plucks on his eye, right? Mm-hmm. And on Muhammad's part, who is the one flapping his wings in the face of Muhammad? It's the Burak. It's the winged horse, right? Yeah. So it's like Crowley is assuming the position of the eye in both of these iconic moments, saying that basically the ministry of Rahor Kui, or the ministry that Iwas comes from, is not new. It's not new. It's been around.
Yeah, which, I mean, why else would it be Egyptoform? Well, of course, because that was popular in the Victorian era, but...
Yeah, there's definitely some portions of it that are, I think, personally, are a product of its time, but mm-hmm. I do think there's some very interesting stuff in Ethylemic scripture.
Yeah, there's... I apologize for derailing for a moment. But
no, it's okay.
Let me get a copy here because I want to get...
Oh!
Yeah, this is the Toronto Thelema copy of the Book of the Law.
You have the Toronto
Thelema? This is our library so far.
Oh, wow.
It's not very big, but, you know, it's a start.
Sure.
And these are kind of hard to come by these days, too.
Yeah, I have just an Amazon copy of it. That's a very crisp copy.
Yeah, if I could get a pile of these, I would, just to have on hand. But, yeah. You know, and, you know, for whatever reason, to give them to people or whatever. For it is the law to give. But let me see if I can find, rather than trying to remember it. I have the first two chapters memorized, but and I should be better with the verses. Incidentally, the code that you were talking about.
Is that in 276? I just remember that because of some sort of numerology stuff.
I thought 76 was the last verse of that chapter, but...
Yeah, it's before. It's a little bit before the end.
Oh, no, you might be right. Yeah, it is 76. Yeah.
Let's go!
Yeah, because it's 79 is the last verse. You know what? That should be easy to remember, too, because I noticed that, if you count the last verse as the end of the hiding of Hadith and blessing and worship to the prophet of the lovely star... if you count up until that, you have 78, which is the number of tarot cards. And then the 79th one puts a seal on it. And then
Not only that, but the Crowley mentions the Kaaba in chapter 3. And the word Kaaba in Arabic gematria is 97, which is the 79 reserves.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah, there's some... There's two reversals. So there's one palindrome kind of in the Book of Law, which is 66. Which is the amount of verses in chapter 1. There's 79, which is in chapter 2. And then there's 75, which is in chapter 3.
Mm-hmm.
So each and every single one of those has some sort of significance of Islamic numerology.
Okay.
So 66 being the first chapter is a gematria value of the divine name, Allah. Aleph valued at 1, Lam valued at 30, Lam valued at 30, Hey valued at 5. Take them all together, you get 66.
Mm-hmm.
So that's already kind of lining up a little bit with the first chapter.
And I was going to say that the last verse, the 66, if you took that as a seal on that chapter, the manifestation of Nuit is at an end, then that leaves 65 up until that point, 65 being
Adonai.
The number of Adonai. So similarly.
Yeah, exactly.
Fun. But... come on, where are we pecking at the eyes of Jesus? Come on. Here we go. And I could be wrong about this, but I felt like there was something slightly just before it.
Yeah.
I am in a secret fourfold word, the blasphemy against all gods of men. Why did that stick out to me?
Maybe because we were talking about the fourfold God in the vision and the voice last night.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, maybe there was nothing to that, and that was just kind of a red herring that I didn't need to derail things.
All right, it's okay. We go off on tangents all the time.
Yeah, here. We'll let it roll.
Yeah, we'll let it be. Now I'm going to segue into my fourth point, and then we can probably just freestyle from that point.
Yeah,
and kind of build off of the 4 points.
Fair enough.
Yeah. We can do a little mix of both, a little mix of fixed schedule stuff and like kind of mutability.
We'll make a word out of your 4 points altogether, and we'll make it blasphemous.
We'll make it super blasphemous. Yeah, awesome. Yeah, so the fourth point we're going to have is the mentioning of Allah in the vision, the voice. So again, something a lot of people think is like Crowley is basically crapping on Orthodox religions, like basically saying religion sucks, don't be a part of it. But if that was the case, why would he start his own?
Yeah.
So
not to mention he had more respect for Islam than he did for Christianity by far.
I can see why. Yeah. I think it's because one of the main reasons why Crowley might have thought that is because we read the Quran as an original script, right? We make it like obligatory to learn how to read the Quran in its original Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And we emphasize that the original Arabic script that it's in, the Quraysh Arabic, as it's called, or Quraishi Arabic, needs to be invoked or intoned by the practitioner in order to have a connection with the deity. With Christianity, although they do have liturgical bases, like they have Latin, they have Greek, and some even churches would even put Hebrew into their liturgy, they kind of, I was asking one of my friends this, how Christianity, its distinguishing factor that I find from Judaism and Islam, I would say, because all the Abrahamic religions have distinguishing factors, but Christianity's distinguishing factor from Judaism and Islam is that the lack of letter mysticism, the lack of they have the cross and they did have symbology in Christianity, but that was more like iconography, kind of like within the cross itself. Within the iconography, the symbology life, from the Eucharist, the sacraments, all these different practices, there's heavy, heavy, heavy occultic, whether they know it or not, like symbology in these sacramental practices in the Christian faith. And with the Islamic and Jewish faith, they still have symbology in the sacraments, but they have a huge emphasis on letter mysticism that I find is pretty.
Yeah, there's a little bit more of that in the Greek Orthodox kind of thing because.
Oh, really?
You know, like the Rho Chi and that sort of thing.
Rho Chi?
Yeah, so the Greek letter Rho looks like a P if you're just thinking of it as English or something like that or Latin. And then the Chi is an X. So when you see that, like, what looks like a P with an X over top of it, that's actually the Rho Chi. And there's like mysticism that you can draw from that kind of thing. But
are you familiar with Aesop's Effie?
Yeah, there's that as well. So we had the word ichthus coming up last night, and that's like commonly seen to be like the initials of a
Jesus
sentence,
Christ is
the words of a sentence.
Yeah, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Yeah,
And various other sorts of, you know, Greek related things. So there's the Greek aspect to things that did get a lot of attention to some extent comparatively, but I mean, even then, it's like the Greek New Testament, but I don't know if the Greek or like the Greek, the Septuagint, for instance, would have had as much attention as the Torah in terms of it certainly wouldn't have had that as much as the Torah in terms of letter mysticism and that sort of thing.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, because the Septuagint was just not seen as the original script, right? It was just like an adapted script. It's just the mass Hellenization of things.
So the Quran has a tradition of that as well,
Letter mysticism? And the occultic traditions? Absolutely. Absolutely. Even if you only want to look at Quran from an Orthodox view, the Quran has something called the Huruf, the mystery letters. So in certain, in the early parts of the Quran, there are these chapters that start with these mystery discombobulated letters. So Aleph, Lam, Mim is one of them. Aleph, Lam, Mim, Sad is one of them. Kaf, Ha, Ya, Ain, Sad is one of them. Just some of them just start with just one letter, like Noon starts with. Now, people for millennia have been trying to decipher this. There's no mentioning of it in Islamic Orthodox scriptures on what it means or what it kind of alludes to, but Hermeticists have cracked it, completely cracked it. So they use gematria, they use their astrological association. Like I said, the original 14 Arabic letters can be condensed into 12, which can line up with the zodiacs. So you can do a fun little thing where you take the virtues of the astrological sign and you line it up with the with the discombobulated letters that start off the chapter, and you find that whatever the astrological significance of those letters are tends to be what the subject matter of the chapter actually is. So
there's definitely something going on.
Yeah, letter mysticism definitely holds a huge role, even in Islamic Orthodoxy, because this kind of like, because like the Orthodox never was adept to like gematria or like symbology in the letters, they were kind of still forced to pick up like letter mysticism, because a lot of these Sufi mystics, they saw it as like hidden codes, and some of them maybe saw them as names of God itself, actually. They saw these actual names as like ways to invoke God in their own respective right. mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Yeah, you might see a lot of letter mysticism if you see the beginnings of certain early Quranic chapters. They have mm-hmm. letter mysticism.
Cool.
But yeah, moving on to my fourth and final point, and then we can freestyle mm-hmm. is the mentioning of Allah as Leviathan in the yeah. vision and the voice. So in that whole ether, I've read just the parts of it because my friends were trying to instill in me that, you know, like Crowley's just slandering Islam and they're using that vision, the voice thing as like almost like their solidification. Because if you read in that, so if anyone's not familiar with what I'm talking about, the third ether in the vision, the voice, Crowley talks about how the four main archdemons are, what's it called? They are, oh, that's the vision of the voice right there. Nice, yeah. Have a alignment with the four world religions gods. So Satan, Belial, Leviathan, and Lucifer. So Crowley likened Satan to Jesus. He likened Lucifer to Brahma. He likened Leviathan to Allah. And he likened Belial to Buddha. I don't align with like a lot of that correspondence, specifically the Belial being Buddha, because I'm pretty sure Buddha never even considered himself to be God in mm-hmm. like the pantheon of Buddhism. That's more of like the more like not really like the deviant sects, but more of like what kind of came after his teachings.
Yeah.
Kind of what kind of came after his teachings. But I see the vision and kind of what he was saying. No pun intended. I see a little bit of the vision what he was doing with that. But yeah, people wonder like, Crowley calls Allah Leviathan. I'm like, no, if you're looking deep within the context of that, what he's really saying is that all of these different, overlords that kind of staple the religion together, they have like what I could say is like they're agents of shadows. So me and my friends kind of dubbed it as. So these like overlords who kind of like staple the world religions together, they have these shadows that kind of do what we kind of describe as separating the wheat from the chaff. So why specifically would the shadow, the shadow agent of God or of the Islamic God be the Leviathan? It's very simple. Leviathan is typically associated with water, right? He's associated with water, lunar forces. I think in some cosmologies, he's even associated with the sin of envy too. So in the Islamic faith, water is an integral part of connecting with God in the Islamic faith. Before you even can read the Quran, before you can even pray, like prostrating towards the sacred temple or the sacred mosque in Mecca, you have to wash yourself. Mm-hmm. There's a specific procedure on how much you must wash yourself. You must wash your face, arms, head, and feet.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this puts you in a state of ritual purity. So attaining ritual purity in Islam is centered around the element of water in Islam. So if you've noticed, within each of those specific shadow aspects of these divine beings, not saying that the divine beings are imperfect, but that these divine beings use what we would view it from our dualistic lens to be an opposite polarity to kind of go into the world and kind of like separate the wheat from the chaff and kind of like go within society. There is, so one of my Thelema friends kind of broke it down that, well, he gave his opinion on Allah and I kind of gave my opinion on why Allah is lined up with Leviathan, but which I explained is because of water. He explained how the usage of these shadow aspects kind of aligns back to the nature or the personality of each divine being. So with Jesus being Satan originally in the Judaic pantheon was a part of the divine council. He was a part of the sons of God or the Bani Elohim.
Mm-hmm.
So he's almost, and he eventually gets characterized almost like a rebellious child, you know, yeah. who is against organization and authority and the powers that be and wants to kind of make his rule, reign over his own kingdom. Sounds a lot like Jesus.
Yeah.
You know? With Brahma being Lucifer, you have the spark of life that kind of Brahma represents, and Lucifer being like the spark of awakening, with the morning star being the first star that rises before the sun rises. The morning star Lucifer basically represents Brahma in the aspect of it's like the spark of creation. Brahma represents like the spark. Brahma, and even in like the orthodox Hindu religions, was never worshipped at all because of some stories, some mythological story. I think it was Saraswati that actually kind of banned him from being worshipped only in like a remote location, India, is he allowed to be worshipped. So Brahma in many cases gets almost like impersonally worshipped, from what I kind of like recall. And so he represents like a spark of creation, like a spark of creativity. So he's kind of known as like the beginning, or kind of like the awakening of creativity.
The light bringer, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the light bringer. Yeah, you got it. Now, we're going to move on to the next one, that being Belial being Buddha. So what I kind of understand by this is that if you look at the Klipoth on the sphere of the 10th sphere, I think it's called Nama, right? The Klipothic demon that surrounds that is Belial. So on the, and there's tons of Kabbalistic stuff in the Vision of the Voice. We went through that and last night. There's tons of Kabbalistic stuff in the Vision of the Voice. So Belial kind of represents like, he represents the darker side of the earth, or the Malkuth. He represents like the shell of the earth. And so you could characterize the Buddhas almost like this, because the Buddhas main center was not anything transcendent. Notice how all these previous ones we talked to were more of the higher sephirots, right? We had like Jesus as Saturn or Satan, which would be Bina, and then you had Brahma as Lucifer, which would be Netzach. But at the lowest end of the tree, which would be Malkuth, and then the husk, or like the shell of that tree would be Nama, you have Belial, which would be, what's it called, a Buddha. Because Buddha is, I guess you can consider Buddha to be almost like a man of the earth in his own perspective, right? He is kind of like a man of the earth, because he basically, in a way, like, is grounded in the basis of just understanding the earth. I told many of my friends about the six realms of samsara, which is the devas, the demigods, the humans, animals, hungry ghosts, and then the denizens of hell. And I explained it to one of my friends. They said, "Oh, all of that, all of those six realms, just Malkuth. It's all just Malkuth, right?" So Malkuth is so vast for the human like experience, and for what we need to be experiencing here, that Buddha kind of like sets like that whole like basis for what you're supposed to do in Malkuth. So everything from teaching, like from samsara to meditating to holisticism, it's not based on achieving like this high state beyond the world. It's actually the state, it's actually to remain in the constraints of Malkuth, but to sanctify it into a better place. And so that's why I kind of saw that, I kind of see the vision, no pun intended, a little bit on what Crowley was saying of Belial being Buddha. Now moving on to the final one, which is Leviathan of Allah. So Leviathan would be, so from what I've placed in my cosmology, you can place Leviathan on Yasod a little bit. You could place Leviathan on Yasod because of Yasod associated with the moon and water and subconsciousness. And another thing is Leviathan is a serpent, which would do with Kundalini, which would do with the overall pleasure of the sacral chakra.
Yeah, and also in the neophyte ritual, there's a reference to Yasod being sort of home to three sort of serpentine devils or whatnot.
So, really? Well, there you go.
So that seems appropriate.
Another thing is that Yasod's angel is Archangel Gabriel. And that's like undisputed by most traditions. Most traditions are kind of wonky on who Michael, who Raphael is. But most people would agree that, for the most part, that Gabriel is a lunar angel, right? So who is the main agent in the Islamic faith? It's Gabriel.
Gabriel. That makes sense. Yeah,
it's Gabriel. So,
interesting.
So, and mind you, I haven't read the full vision of voice. I'm sure this will make a lot more sense when I piece it together. But for I've pieced together, all in all, in conclusion, there is tons of Islamic representation in modern Hermeticism and even in what we're here for today, talking about the Lema.
Yeah.
Because Crowley never saw, and like I said about his confessions earlier, he never saw the Sufic path and the ceremonial magician's path as mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the two as pursuits towards a similar goal.
Yeah.
And saw the trials and saw like the effects of doing what your sacramental practices is as one and the same. And where when Sufis say, I've reached Al-Fana and I've like, you know, I've aligned myself with the divine body or the divine, like, kind of like alignment. Same way that someone would say, I've successfully crossed the abyss. Mm-hmm. I've looked past the, I think it's called Zax. I think it's called where the 10th ether.
Yeah, in the Aethers, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and that makes total sense to me because of the fact that it's like, well, if these things are actually talking about real experiences that exist in our universe, then they would be describing the same experiences, and as opposed to, oh, well, I'm talking about Lord of the Rings and you're talking about Harry Potter. These are two different universes or something like that, you know, where the rules are different. I feel like sometimes people get that kind of a mentality about things where it's like, you know, no, this is over here and this is different from that over there. It's like,
yeah.
No, these are just different language sets to some extent. And if they're talking about something, I would expect to see similar actual existing phenomena in nature, you know?
That does segue into what I wanted to conclude this with, and that is that Crowley seems to signify that these four archdemons in the aspect of four of the creator gods of the different religions are different scopes of perceiving his works, is what I've also seen as. So you can take, like, you can almost view them as like paths almost. You could, no matter how you break it down or no matter how you re-rock it, remix it, flavor with it, you could get a Christian decoding of it, which is why you have Jesus in there. You could get a Buddhist decoding of it, which I've heard a lot of my friends say that Crowley and the Book of Allah has a lot of tantric information that only initiates to really understand. And so I didn't really specify, but there's a lot of tantra in the Book of Allah that kind of flew over a lot of people's head. Just like how I'm looking at the Islamic stuff, and that's flying over a lot of people's head. There's a lot of tantric stuff that's flying over my head too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's the tantric stuff in Buddhism, which tantra isn't like confined to Buddhism, but it's most well-refined in Buddhism, in my opinion, I would say. And then there's the Hindu views of it, which, you know, they talk about the Eye of Shiva repeatedly in the Book of Allah, a book of the Vision of Voice, or 418. So that's why you have Brahma in there. Then you have finally the Islamic path, where you can tread through like the Thelemic scriptures with an Islamic kind of lens and see where you can align your Islamic will in like the framework of what Crowley has kind of like built.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting. I'm somewhat, honestly, when people come to me for Thelema information, like a lot of my friends that kind of know me as the Thelema guy, they kind of know me as like the guy into Crowley, but I mean, heck, I talked about the Islamic presence in his works for the past I lost track
minutes.
Of time. Yeah, hour and 40 minutes. So, yeah. It's pretty interesting stuff. But although I wouldn't consider myself too much of a Thelemite, rather I consider myself just an Islamic Hermeticist who's trying to see different avenues for how Neo-Hermeticism has evolved. And like the avenue that I've seen is the most mainstream, at least in the area that I'm in, Toronto, seems to be the Thelema kind of avenue. I've kind of been adept to kind of be like, okay, like, so Thelema seems to be like kind of like the main like neo-hermetic kind of community that's in my area. Mm-hmm. Why don't I get like to know like some of the doctrine there? And I was just blown away of how much like Islam is actually in there, how much like the presence of Islam is actually present in there, where people would be like, where the average Shalomite would tell me, this is this Crowley being kind of wagging their finger at me, this is this Crowley dissing your religion. I'm like, it's quite literally him including it, but okay.
Yeah, you know, even on that note, like where that appears in the Vision and the Voice, Aether 3, one of the things that I want to point out as well is that the wording of it is that there are four devils, Satan, Lucifer, Leviathan, Belial, and that are the great princes of the evil of the world. And Satan is worshipped by men under the name of Jesus. And Lucifer is worshipped by men under the name of Brahman. And I wanted to point out the wording of this thing. I could continue on with the other two, but it's worshipped by men, not saying, and Satan is Jesus.
It's worshipped by men.
That, to me, is a really important distinction.
It's an important distinction because it's not saying that they're the actual deity. It's saying that that's who they end up egregorially contacting instead of the deity itself.
That to me says something about the human responsibility in regards to the worship that's happening. So
yes,
it's sort of like when people use you're doing this is blasphemous against this god, my god, and so I'm going to kill you, or I'm going to do something, you know, horrible to you, and that sort of thing. It's like justifying your actions and attributing them to God. You know, which to me is blasphemy.
justifying hatred and justifying bigotry in the name of God is definitely something.
Yeah, especially when it's hypocritical and it's like you claim to have certain beliefs and certain practices and certain conduct and that sort of thing, but your actions actually don't bear you out, you know? So it's kind of like that to me is sort of saying this is kind of the inadvertent sort of worship of a devil, where you're claiming that you're worshiping this god, you know?
that's very true. Yeah, that's why I was also not too quick to write it off. A lot of my friends are just trying to writing up because it says in the brackets at the end of that, this is the meaning behind the passage in chapter 3.
The Book of the Law, yeah.
Yeah, but knowing Crowley, he would never impose a specific reading on the reader.
Unless
he was doing it for a specific reason, you know?
I mean, this again is like a case of like he's the context for these aethers is that he's in the desert with Victor Newberg. Victor Newberg is acting as the scribe. Crowley's having the vision, and he's reciting what's happening to him and what information he's getting from these angels and whatnot. Sure. So he's claiming that this is information being passed to him, and he's dictating it to Victor Newberg and that sort of thing. And the in brackets where it says this is the meaning of the passage, I feel like that's him specifically acknowledging that that's the first thing that comes to his mind.
So you think it's a Victor Newberg kind of?
No, I think that's still Crowley, but I think it's like him sort of acknowledging, okay, that relates to chapter 3 where these things appear in the Book of the Law. But there's a note here I'm going to read, and I don't know if this is in your version of it as well.
Most likely isn't.
It says it's in these triangular brackets, so that's referring to something in the manuscript of these notes that it looks to be a note that Crowley made referring to that bracketed part that says, "My own silly note?" with a question mark.
Yeah. Even he was perplexed. Like, why am I confined to like a certain reading of the Book of Allah? I always wanted people just to read it however they wanted to, but I'm like, why am I doing this? Even he was kind of like confounded on why he would do something
exactly.
that in the first place.
So.
I think I do remember reading that actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Eh? It's like there's always context is important, and it's not always as obvious as you think it is. And so, like, to be kind of have a reactionary kind of apologetical approach where you're either accusing Crowley of being this or apologizing for Crowley being that, it's kind of like, well, maybe it's not quite so simple as you think it is, and maybe there's something that you just sort of, not to mention the fact that it's like you just might have to read it a couple of times and kind of
100%. Or you could be actually learned in the religion he's slandering and being like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You should stop assuming that Crowley is ignorant of these terminologies and start realizing, I kind of didn't be like, nah, he definitely knows what's up, because that's the first thing that came to mind when he said, I flapped my wings in the face of Muhammad and blah. I'm like, that's probably referencing the Burak.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably referencing the Burak.
Yeah.
And a lot of people call me out there for that, but I mean,
no, that's interesting. And that's the thing, I think, like with especially when it comes to something like the Book of the Law, but even when it comes to other holy texts as well, I feel like that's the reason the Book of the Law, in my opinion, ends with something that's like a little comment that says, this is not the contents of this book are not to be discussed. And yeah, it's like, in my opinion, that's the reason why it's so important to be sensible and keep aware when you're talking about these things, because it's not like to say that it has one meaning and this is what the meaning is, basically Crowley was racist or prejudiced or something like that, and he was just being bigoted and insulting towards this other group of people, then that's potentially taking away from all these other possible interpretations and deeper meanings that you might potentially be able to find, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe at a different point in time, maybe right now, this has like the idea that you're sort of putting forth as the Burak, which maybe later on down the road, you'll discover a deeper meaning or a different way of taking it that might, you know, create a whole different, you know.
Awesome.
So, yeah, that's the thing. These things, holy texts, I feel like are living texts.
Okay.
You know, they live with you. They live through you.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And you engage with them and they can...
You utilize them. You subjugate your outer surroundings with the power of the text.
But they also, they live, they evolve, you know, as you evolve.
They do evolve as you evolve, yeah. Mm.
But yeah, that's great. You know, like, we've gotten a lot of interesting ideas there, just from a very different framework than, you know, we'll usually be talking about on this. So, thanks very much for bringing some of these ideas to the table.
Thank you, man.
And yeah, a lot of food for thought. So
yeah, 100%. I wanted to come here to open an honest dialogue between Islamic like occultism and thelema, because you know, like people think it's like, well, Islam is very restrictive and thelema is very freeing. How could the two be like kind of mutually exclusive? It's because, well, it has a lot to do with the fact that in Islamic occultism, they have quite liberalistic values in the aspect of it's like, we care more about how you're intending to do what you're doing rather than like what you actually do. Now, there's a lot of Islamic values I still hold very true to. Like, I don't drink alcohol. I mean, I'd be smoking a little bit of ganja, but I don't drink alcohol. I don't consume usury.
I noticed you looking over at that bottle of J&B, by the way. I don't know if you were actually looking at that or not, but
I
don't drink alcohol anymore myself. And I wanted to point out that bottle of J&B is because in old Italian genre films, they would always have a bottle of J&B in the background. So I specifically got that.
Oh, that's nice. You like to see your life as a movie.
Yeah. It's just a little prop. And since this is an audio podcast, no one would ever know otherwise. So
awesome.
So
awesome. Nice.
But the other consideration as far as like Islamic tradition and that sort of thing is that there's a lot of different Islamic traditions.
Yes,
like there's one school of thought.
Isn't. And even in Hellenistic Islamic thinking, you have Pythagorean Muslims, you have Socratic Muslims, you have the most famous being Neoplatonic and Aristotelian Muslims, right? So it's like Hermeticism to me kind of groups all those different Hellenistic Muslim thinkers and kind of like lets them know like, hey, this is like how you bunch it all together and how you kind of put it all into one thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
Any books you might want to recommend or anything like that come to mind? Not to put you on the spot, but
I mean, outside of what I've written, I mean, if you're trying to get, I mean, the book I just showed today, The Imaginibus, that's a really good introduction to the Christopher Warnock and John Michael Greer version. I would recommend because it gives a brief the history, even if you don't understand any of the inscriptions or any of the instructions in it, that's okay. I think that it still has value in the Christopher Warnock and Greer version, where they give the history of Sabian Huronians and how they dispersed across the country and how they became prominent in the Abbasid dynasty. Mm. So that's one of them. These books I'm listing can be found in Amazon. Mm-hmm. But the second book I'll recommend is the Mus'haf As-Su'ar. Now, the Mus'haf As-Su'ar is the Book of Pictures, and it is a visual alchemical text by, you may know him, Zosimos of Panopolis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Zosimos was a
How's he doing anyway? No, I'm kidding.
How is he doing more than 1,000 years later?
Oh, I guess I should have checked in sooner, yeah.
Yeah, I guess his alchemy didn't make him immortal.
Yeah, as far as we know.
As far as we know, yeah. So Zosimos, if people are unaware, was a Gnostic Egyptian alchemist who did a lot of influential things for, like, specifically Islamic alchemy, actually. Islamic alchemy, very, very influenced by Zosimos. They called him Rusam, which was, like, his, like, Arabic kind of, like, Latinization almost, or Romanization. What they called them, Rusam, or Isumu. So Rusam was, like, kind of... I searched up, like, a bunch of different, like, Arabic versions of it, and Rusam was the one that really stuck out to me. Rusam or Zosimos had his book, the Mus'haf As-Su'ar, which was obviously the title was in Arabic, so it was heavily influential amongst Islamic alchemists. Funny enough, too, the Samaritan table, or the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, not to be confused with Emerald Tablet of Thoth the Atlantean, but of Hermes Trismegistus, where it's, you know, truth certainly, that which I would doubt, as above, is as so below. That specific book, you guys can get that anywhere. It's only like a page long.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Jabir ibn Hayyan?
Not offhand.
Jabir ibn Hayyan was actually the founder of crystallization.
Oh, okay.
In the field of alchemy. Yeah, I think even sublimation too. Cool. But he founded crystallization and sublimation. He coined it in the field of alchemy, which ended up, I think, getting even used towards some of the alchemical processes that lead up to the Philosopher's Stone. Mm-hmm. So Jabir ibn Hayyan was one of those voices that... He's best known for actually making the earliest manuscripts of the Emerald Tablet of Hermes is actually in Arabic. They're Arabic manuscripts.
Cool.
So a lot of, even like a lot of the Corpus Hermeticum that survives today, they would have extracted a lot of it from Arabic copies of it that came from the Abbasid era.
Yeah.
So the Abbasid era saw I think even the Asclepius too, they had some Asclepius manuscripts too, but they saw that the Corpus Hermeticum, so those are two other books I'm recommending, Corpus Hermeticum and Emerald Tablet, possibly even the Asclepius too, but that's like a more auxiliary one.
Yeah.
But Corpus Hermeticum was said by the Abbasid Caliphate to be ancient prophetic wisdom. So they held Corpus Hermeticum to high regard. They held the Emerald Tablet to high regard in terms of their alchemy. And finally, of course, if I'm going to give one more book or recommendation, I would absolutely recommend the Ghayat al-Hakim or the Picatrix.
Yeah.
Again, even if you are not familiar with any of the terminologies, there, still a very good read for getting a glimpse of what Sabian or like Eastern Neoplatonism and Eastern Hermeticism kind of look like and kind of was practiced. That's pretty much all the book recommendations I got.
Cool. And yeah, for your own books.
Oh, for my own books.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about that? Sure. Yeah.
So it's published under Uthman Ken?
Yes, it is. Uthman space Ken. That's my name on Amazon. Yeah. So out of my four publications, I want to say there's two that I would say were at least pertinent to what we were talking about today. The first one, which is like on Amazon for less than $10, is The Blinding Wings. And where if you notice, it harps on the I flap my wings in the face of Muhammad and blind him. I took that and I titled it my book as homage to that. So it's like The Blinding Wings is a numerical breakdown of the Book of the Law of Secret. It's a purely numerological text. It's like a numerological, I want to claim it's like almost like a numerological artifact almost I made in my own respective rights. And where the point is to keep it to know what the decode is. Once you've read it, know the decode.
So it's a reference.
Yeah, referential. So the Binding Wings is a numerological decoding of the first, the chapter 2, verse 76 of the Book of Allah, within the first verse of the Quran, which means Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, which means in the name of God, most merciful, especially merciful. Mm-hmm. So that whole, that delves deep within the constraints of like understanding like Islamic numerology and combining it with the Lemic numerology. And then finally, in terms of like, I was going to give two out of the four publications I made. So the second publication I would say is like really interesting is Kabbalistic Sufism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brief yet broad synthesis on Hermetic, Hebraic, and Sufic mysticism,
mm-hmm.
where I make the likes of, I do three types of sections, and where I do the systematics, the angelology, and the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell how Kabbalistic philosophy aligns with Sufic philosophy, how Kabbalistic angelology aligns with Sufic angelology, and how Kabbalistic systematics aligns with Sufic systematics. So within Kabbalistic Sufism, which is my best-selling book on Amazon right now, I would give that one. Mm-hmm. And also because it's relevant to this topic,
mm-hmm.
I synthesize Hebraic and Kermetic mysticism with the Sufic body and aim to like branch how, yes, Sufism didn't have an overt practice of Kabbalah, but the beauty of the Kabbalah is that one is tapping into these trees upon trees within the constraints of the symbology and the sacraments and the practices without them having to even have a sense of it in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I am no way I'm saying the tree of life is in the Quran or saying that, you know, like the Kabbalah.
The tree of life is in the Quran, you say?
Yeah. And I
apologize.
Yeah, that's all good. Yeah, I in no way am saying that Kabbalah is like an explicitly titled like thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I kind of get to when people kind of challenge me and be like, tell me where the zodiacs or the planets or the magic is in the Quran, I'm like, I will, but what I'm going to let you know is that if you're looking for the Quran to basically say, and verily we have given you the zodiac, and verily we have given you the planets, and verily we have given you magic, you're out of luck, no cigar, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the symbology and when you look at the mystical implications behind some of the miracles, when you look at some of the stories even, there is an abundance of Hermetic thought. That's rich in Islamic stuff. One more book I recommend, that's not mine,
mm-hmm.
is Esoteric Islam by Sakal Smith.
Okay.
This is a, you don't even have to read this book. You could find his article that he has the entire book on an article form. But Esoteric Islam by Sakal Smith has breakdowns of how the Quran is embedded with Hermetic symbology and initiations and rites and practices.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are all my book recommendations.
Cool. And
yeah, thank you.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming out today. And
oh, thank you there.
Very much appreciate it. And it's, yeah, it's a lot of fun chatting about some of these ideas and things. So
yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much and appreciate it. 93.
93, brother. Peace out.
Thanks for listening. Find Toronto Falima online. Like, comment, share, and subscribe, and help us grow. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.